Blog Talk Radio.
Found me. This is Masonic Companion. I'm your host for the next little while, Dale Graham. And I'm trying not to get choked up over it. Welcome. This is the 145th day of the year, the 25th of May, 2014. So all in all, a pretty good day. I'm going to talk about some things Masonic. Some music that has a bearing on what's going on around us. It's probably the most perfect day of the year so far. I want to just remind you that around the time of, if you want a little bit of a benchmark, a little mnemonic here, a little memory prompt, around the time of Perry, you can, and this will work both ways, around the time of Perry's naval victory on Lake Erie, what this has to do with the show today, it's just one of those fascinating little things. It was about the time, it was the same year, that the moderns and the ancients became reconciled and formed the United Grand Lodge of Ancient Freemasons, December 27th, 1813. So a little bit, just think, 1813, the reconciliation, it's also a time of naval victory in Lake Erie. So, that's all I got for right now. That's all I got. We're going to start the program with a bit of music here today, talk a little bit. And the first piece is by an Italian composer, Antonio Vivaldi. And of course, I'm taking a piece from the violin concerto from the Four Seasons, it'll be spring. It's wonderful. Vivaldi was a very interesting philanthropic composer, a virtuoso violinist, of course. And he was born on the 4th of March of 1678. He was what's known today as an Italian Baroque composer. And the Baroque music is a style of aesthetic occurred somewhere between 1600 and 1750. Following the Renaissance, and it was followed by the classical eras. But the word Baroque comes from the Portuguese word Barroco, meaning misshapen pearl. And it's a negative description of the ornate and heavily ornamented music of the period. So, you know, it's a negative description. So think about other ways that you use it in negative descriptors. Then later the name came to apply to architecture of very ornate and heavily ornamented. And this forms, Baroque music forms a major portion of the classical music and the composers here. It's interesting. For those of you who are relatively new, you know, developing your taste in the arts and sciences, the Baroque period is filled with some really interesting and composers, Johann Sebastian Bach, George Frederick Handel. You know, he was doing all those pieces every week for the king, and Scarlatti, both Alessandro and Domenico Scarlatti. Look for their harpsichord music. Henry Purcell, George Telemann, beautiful music from Telemann, one of my favorites. And Arcangelo Corelli, the fantastic. Google these guys if you're interested, and don't belabor the point. I won't belabor the point this morning. But get yourself in a good frame of mind, relaxed frame of mind, to let your mind, open your mind, and let it absorb. This is music that's been transcendent. It connects people to emotion for hundreds of years. How it does that isn't just the excitement of contemporary tunes. Don't get me wrong. We have access to some, you know, great reproductive music systems. It's just the clarity is there. No more scratching, although I still like some turntable scratchery. So you're going to hear a little bit about that later in the program. But we have a way of responding to certain types of sound. And you know, the sound is all, music is computations, mathematical. We also know now the volume range that elicits the emotion, and that's at a 50 decibel. That's loud. That's loud. If you've listened to a jazz band in play, it is loud. If you listen to a symphony, it is loud. But if you're wondering yourself, you're driving, and you have, you know, if you have that kind of setting feedback, get it up to 50, and then let the music have its effect. It affects us deeply, and well, the scientists are trying to find out the nature of that. Maybe it's part of our limbic brain area. That's the most primitive part of the brain, the oldest, think of it that way, oldest part of the brain. So today we're going to play a little bit of music from Antonio Vivaldi, and it's done by a brilliant violinist, Itzhak Perlman. We'll just give you a little bit of a taste of what Vivaldi thought of the spring. Vivaldi was a pretty interesting guy. Many of his compositions were written for female music ensemble, for to be performed by a home for abandoned children, where Vivaldi, he was an ordained Catholic priest, and he was working there from 1703 to 1715. So he began doing music. He also was very successful with expensive stagings of his operas. You know, he was moved around in refined circles. He was befriended by Emperor Charles VI, as much as an emperor would befriend anybody at the time. And then he moved to Vienna. But after he arrived there, the emperor died. And Vivaldi died less than a year later, and he was broke. Not baroque, broke. See what you think of the man's beautiful music. We'll just play a little sample of it, and we'll get into some other interesting things Masonic. Thank you. Beautiful music. Beautiful music. I think today's show was titled Mystery and Freemasonry, Innovations on Genius. And I think that's what we are. We are that group of people that have pulled together and recognized that there are people on the face of the earth, tribal and theological, who have felt and been defined as the chosen people. And it's an interesting way of, it once, I think, not as a competition to berate other people, but as a line in that, you know, the sand. We say, if you are defined a certain way, do you have obligations to live up to that? Is that an ongoing challenge? And what more noble challenge could there be than to be worthy of, to earn by your grace and your commitment and your generosity to the people around you, your family, your friends, and your community, your country, to earn the title of being special, of being memorable, not as putting the heel on the throat of some other man, never, but of being an inspiration, showing the world how humble people can do great things. It's important, isn't it? It's important to be able to have those kind of benchmarks. Many of us in the struggle through early life didn't have people around us that pointed these things out. It's not to say, and never make the mistake, that the philosophy is only in the halls of the scholars. If somebody was to say that, they've never sat at the side or worked beside an old farmer or a tradesman or a merchant. There are people who resonate, who have questions and search out answers. And those are the people that inspire, and they're different. And they come from many different walks of life. Sometimes, yes, they have been monarchs. More often, though, monarchs are very few in the face of the earth, in the world's history. More often, there's more of us. There's more of the common man. And out of the common man comes great things, great misery. But we are the common man and the great equalizer. Huh? We breathe in, we breathe out. As a grown man, I want to see how this fits with you, please, and give me some feedback on it. Think about it. As a grown man, being defined with symbols is interesting. Freemasonry, eh? Redefines us. You become a rank, you become a something, a someone. I think I am quite average at this age, having partial answers to some, but not all of the elemental questions pertinent to my life. In a way, it takes this kind of effort to balance an aging conscience to engage the world authentically. I do that to understand the nature of trust and gain control of emotion. These are difficult elements. My sense of this is incomplete. These are tasks within Freemasonry, though. If you read and it pops out at you, I wish you well on your Masonic journey. We hear that a lot. Can I be honest with you? It never really sat well with me because it felt it was usually given to implant a conceit. Like, aren't I clever saying a phrase to the initiate that he doesn't understand? I know that's mean. That's not the intention. But I am sharing my thoughts. Dangerous stuff to talk about conceits, I know. Not conceited. We all have conceits. But the mathematics of the sentence, you know, I wish you well on your Masonic journey, is wrong to me. Because he is left untaught. Everyone comes into life alone and in relationship. the same time. Interesting. For relationship to this warmth, this heartbeat that you've been able to pick up from the first moment that your auditory and nervous system was in place. That's your mother. But we are alone. There's nobody else being born at that moment. Oh, the twin? You know what I mean. Philosophically, we come into this world as we are. Fingers and toes, nose and eyes. How we conduct our life is about choices we make after those moments. I think Freemasons generally agree each new member is part of the order. We're part of it. We don't ask, we just assume that. Joining us to explore the meaning of a life well lived. Our ritual gives an opportunity, not answers, but an atmosphere to be a learner of philosophy and geometry, science, the arts, sociology and history. We are in a mystery school in the truest sense. We are the alchemists seeking knowledge. An intelligent man will understand that deeper growth only possible through respect of a higher power and mankind. That's that social phenomena. We like to be with our own kind of creatures. We like to congregate in groups, huh? But the mind, the contemplative mind, is alone there. Freemasonry helps us understand the work of that achievement. Amen to that. Don't walk away disappointed, impatient, and frustrated. We've been looking for you, that inquiring mind. Do you have the temperament and intelligence to proceed? Natural talent is rare. Most of us achieve by hard work. That's a choice. The people that seem to have raised to a station in life by privilege and connections, you're absolutely right. Malcolm Gladwell taught us that. For the rest, we achieve. We just heard Itzhak Perlman. You could even hear his fingers hitting the keyboard on his violin, the neck of his violin. He was able to do that to nurse the roundness of each note, the terseness of each note, the emotion from repeated effort. And remember, the effort to reach that level of virtuosity in any aspect of life is 10,000 hours. Those who achieve have put in that much time. Whether it's an inside fastball, whether it's an Olympic skier, whether it's hitting the high C in an opera, whether it's the craft and trade of being a machinist at the very best, metallurgist at the very best, your professors, your instructors, 10,000 hours. Think about it, eh? Think about it. We have interesting news around the world today, but I want you to think about, just keep in mind the context of belonging, that sense that we're connected, and it's a feeling that we have to allow to happen. Nobody's going to make us feel that way. William Glasser said this. He says we are driven by five genetic needs: survival, love and belonging, power, freedom, and fun. Positive feelings come from being honest about yourself and accepting your personality and physical characteristics, warts and all, and from belonging to a family that accepts you without question. Well, that's an actor said that. But Marilyn Monroe, you know, sort of that tragic beauty of the 50s and 60s, I am involved in a freedom ride protesting the loss of the minority rights belonging to the few remaining earthbound stars. All we demanded was our right to twinkle. Interesting times, eh? Interesting times. Frank Lloyd Wright, the architect, said, "No house should ever be on a hill or on anything. It should be of the hill, belonging to it. Hill and house should live together, each the happier for the other." And that complementarity. If you want that, you want that experience. You see others that seem to have it, or you're craving that in the way you define your progress, the progress of insight. If you want it, be it. Be it. Act it. How would a man act if he lived a world of insight, if he had achieved it? How would he speak? Would he struggle to be aware 24 hours a day? Yes, of course I think he would. Until he began to accept began to realize that insight at a certain level is beyond words. It's a state of what? Being, a state of mind beyond definition? Be that. Be that cheerful, smiling addition. The work of it is to connect, to find that complementary balance. That's the work that this processor that sits on top of our shoulders allows us to do, if you set your mind to it. If you're looking to live a life free of distress, it's possible. It is. It's entirely possible. You have the tools you need right in front of you. Right in front of you. Here's a little something that I think you're going to like. You know, we have to come back to just before we get into some music by Brother George Gershwin. One of the chosen few. I want to talk. I've been promising to talk about landmarks, and these are very hard or, you know, complicated. And don't you notice that some fellows have sort of come at this with a ruler? We have this many, and you don't have any, and we define it this way. You're in this jurisdiction, we have a different kind of measure. Maybe, yeah, okay, if you're thinking it's just because we haven't gotten around to it, maybe we need to count them up and put them down on paper. Well, okay. But we do it different for reasons. The devil in the detail is to search out the history and find out what the reasons are. Why do we do it the way we do it? I'm sorry, but I'm not a big fan of promoting Freemasonry as a governance structure. Oh, dear, I'm sorry. I know, the skies are darkening over my head right now, and the lightning bolts, you can smell the sulfur in the air. It's just crackling to get at me. But I think Freemasonry is that spirit, that dangerous, philosophical, esoteric spirituality. That's the essence of Freemasonry. That's the essence of a connection with that star in the east, Sirius, and what that says to your mind. Now, whatever this says doesn't really matter. It's what it means to you. What's it mean to you? Yeah. I'm doing a book review here too. Blatant promotion, not of my book. That'll come later, I suppose. But I've been asked about that. So this is from a book called Masonry Defined. And if you're inclined to get a book, this would be one that I think you should you would find very interesting. And this was given to me by a friend a long time ago, many when I was just a little baby Freemason. And he sort of took a shine. I always felt he took a shine to me, took me under his wing, gave me a little bit of guidance. His name is Wolf Geimer. Yeah, he's an interesting guy. Masonry defined, a liberal Masonic education. Information every Mason should have. And this was compiled, as he says in his frontispiece, from the writings of Dr. Albert G. Mackay, 33rd degree, and many other eminent authorities. And this is by E.R. Johnston, originator of the questionnaire system of Masonic education. So, National Masonic Press, Tennessee. My copy, no, this is the first edition, 11th of January, 1930. So check this out. See what you think. His whole process is, the whole book is full of the questions. What rules apply to the relief of Masonic widows and orphans? I'll just go through a few of them. What was the origin of Masonic warrants? What regulations govern the right of a lodge to do the work of ancient craft masonry? What is the proper title of a master of a lodge and why? What is the Masonic meaning of the word worthy? Has a Mason the right to visit any lodge where he happens to be? And what are the Masonic teachings of Freemasonry? There's hundreds of that. 900, 1100. Let's see. That's the hundreds and hundreds of questions that he put. Actually, who is the builder of the second temple? That's the 1025th question. So this is the way that it's taught, through questions. A questionnaire. What is the basis of Masonic chronology in the year of Masonry? That was question 1023. So he goes through definitions, and then he goes through answering these questions. Remember, this is up to 1930 when it was published. So the work would have been pre-1930. And I say that because a lot's changed in the last, 90 years? 80 years? That's added to our knowledge. So today we may have sort of a variation on this work. But sit back and enjoy this for what it is. It's like looking through an atlas from 1925 and just see it. It's not like, oh, gee, it's not useful. It's incredibly useful because it tells us about a time gone by. And it sort of it gives us that idea where we've been. Now, all you do is I hope you're feeling connected with the show right now. I'm going to talk to you about the ancient landmarks, and then we'll get into some Gershwin. In ancient times, it was the custom to mark the boundaries of lands by means of stone pillars, the removal of which by malicious persons would be the occasion of much confusion, men having no other guide than these pillars by which to distinguish the limits of their property. To remove them, therefore, was considered a heinous crime. Thou shalt not, says the Jewish law, remove thy neighbor's landmark, which they of old time have set in thine inheritance. Hence, those peculiar landmarks of distinction by which we are separated from the profane world, and by which we are enabled to designate our inheritance as the sons of light, are called the landmarks of the order. The universal language and the universal laws of Masonry are landmarks, but not so are the local ceremonies, laws, and usages, which vary in different countries. To attempt to alter or remove these sacred landmarks, by which we examine and prove a brother's claims to share in our privileges, is one of the most heinous offenses that a Mason can commit. In the decision of the question, what are and what are not the landmarks of Masonry, there has been much diversity of opinion among writers. Dr. Oliver says that, quote, some restrict them to the obligation, signs, tokens, and words. Others include the ceremonies of initiation, passing, and raising, and the form, dimensions, and support. The ground, situation, and covering, the ornaments, furniture, and jewels of a lodge, or their characteristic symbols. Some think that the order has no landmarks beyond its peculiar secrets. Fair enough. But all of these are loose and unsatisfactory definitions, excluding things that are essential and admitting others that are unessential. Perhaps the safest method is to restrict them to those ancient and therefore universal customs of the order, which either gradually grew into operation as rules of action, or if once enacted by a competent authority, were enacted at a period so remote that no account of their origin is to be found in the records of history. Both the enactors and the time of the enactment have passed away from the record, and landmarks are therefore, quote, of higher antiquity than memory or history can reach. The first requisite, therefore, of a custom or rule of action to constitute it a landmark is that it must have existed from, quote, time whereof the memory of man runneth not to the contrary. There's no other memory that would argue. Its antiquity is its essential element. Were it possible for all the Masonic authorities at the present day to unite in a universal Congress and in the most perfect unanimity to adopt any new regulation, although such regulation would, so long as it remained unrepealed, be obligatory on the whole craft, yet it would not be a landmark. It would have the character of universality, it is true, but it would be wanting in that of antiquity. Another peculiarity of these landmarks of Masonry is that they are unrepealable. As the Congress to which I have just alluded would not have the power to enact a landmark, so neither would it have the prerogative of abolishing one. The landmarks of the order, like the laws of the Medes and the Persians, can suffer no change. What they were centuries ago, they still remain and must so continue to force, in force until Masonry itself shall cease to exist. Until the year 1858, no attempt had been made by any Masonic writer to distinctively enumerate the landmarks of Masonry and to give to them a comprehensible form. In October of that year, the author of this work published in the American Quarterly Review of Freemasonry an article on the foundations of Masonic laws, which contained a distinct enumeration of the landmarks, which was the first time that such a list had been presented to the fraternity. It has since been very generally adopted by the fraternity and republished by many writers on Masonic law, sometimes without any acknowledgement of the source whence they derived their information. Accordingly to this recapitulation, the result of much labor and research, the landmarks have 25 in number, and they are as follows. I'll try and get through them, and I'll shrink them down, if you don't mind, brethren and guests. The modes of recognition are, of all the landmarks, the most legitimate and unquestioned. The modes of recognition, that's the first. They admit of no variation, and if ever they have suffered alteration or addition, the evil of such a violation of the ancient law has always been made itself subsequently manifest. The division of symbolic masonry into 3 degrees is a landmark that has been better preserved than almost any other, although even here the mischievous spirit of innovation has left its traces. And by the disruption of its concluding portion from the 3rd degree, a want of uniformity has been created in respect to the final teaching of the Master's Order and the Royal Arch of England, Scotland, Ireland, and America, and the higher degrees of France and Germany, are all made to defer to the mode in which they lead the neophyte to the great consummation of all symbolic masonry. In 1813, wasn't that the year Perry won a battle on Lake Erie? And the year that the Grand Lodge unified? The 1813, the ancients and moderns came together. The Grand Lodge of England vindicated the ancient landmark by solemnly enacting that ancient craft masonry consisted of the 3 degrees of entered apprentice, fellow craft, and master mason, including the Holy Royal Arch. But the disruption has never been healed, and the landmark, although acknowledged in its integrity by all, still continues to be violated. The third, the legend of the 3rd degree is an important landmark, the integrity of which has been well preserved. There is no rite of Freemasonry practiced in any country or language in which the essential elements of this legend are not taught. The lectures may vary and indeed are constantly changing, but the legend has ever remained substantially the same. And it is necessary that it should be so, for the legend of the temple builder constitutes the very essence and identity of Masonry. Any rite which should exclude it or materially alter it would at once, by that exclusion or alteration, cease to be a Masonic rite. The fourth, the government of the fraternity by a presiding officer called a Grand Master, who is elected from the body of the craft, is a fourth landmark of the order. Many persons suppose that the election of the Grand Master is held in consequence of a law or regulation of Grand Lodge. Such, however, is not the case. Grand Masters, or persons performing the functions under a different but equivalent title, are to be found in the records of the institution long before Grand Lodges were established. And if the present system of legislative government by Grand Lodges were to be abolished, a Grand Master would still be necessary. Remember, if the present system of legislative government by Grand Lodges were to be abolished, so he's saying that is a possibility, the Grand Master would still be necessary. Yep. The presiding officer. The fifth, the prerogative of the Grand Master to preside over every assembly of the craft, wheresoever and whensoever held, is a fifth landmark. It is in consequence of this law, derived from ancient usage, and not from any special enactment, that the Grand Master assumes the chair, or as it is called in England, the throne, at every communication of the Grand Lodge, and that he is also entitled to preside at the communication of every subordinate lodge where he may happen to be present. The sixth, and this will be the last that I'll read to get into today, the prerogative of the Grand Master to give dispensation for conferring degrees at irregular times is another and very important landmark. Dispensation. The statutory law of Freemasonry requires a month or other determinate period to elapse between the presentation of a petition and the election of a candidate. But the Grand Master has the power to set aside or dispense with his probation and to allow a candidate to be initiated at once. This prerogative he possessed from the enactment of the law required a probation, and as no statute can impair his prerogative, he still retains the power. I'm just teasing here. This is the last. The seventh landmark, the prerogative of the Grand Master to give dispensation for the opening and holding of lodges is another landmark. He may grant, in virtue of this, to a sufficient number of Masons, the privilege of meeting together and conferring degrees. The lodges thus established are called lodges under dispensation. Worth a look if you get a chance. Remember, this is an interesting reference. Masonry defined: a liberal Masonic education easily obtained, by Johnston. And you'll find this National Masonic Press. It's out of print, of course, and it's a fascinating read. Now, I've been talking a little too. We need to just take a little bit of a break, but I want to talk to you about some music by one of the craft, George Gershwin. You might have heard Rhapsody in Blue. We'll play it another time. That's 1924, and you know, around Masonic Companion, we are fans of the old tunes too. And then he did An American in Paris. Remember that? Gene Kelly did it as a musical in the. This is music that we're going to play today from an opera that he did, or an operetta, we would call it in the strictest sense, Porgy and Bess, that was produced in 1935, right in between the wars. Gershwin studied piano and composition. He was a very serious musician. He was born Jacob Gershwin. on the 26th of September, 1898. Victoria was still on the throne. He was born in Brooklyn, New York. And he moved to Paris, and that's where he began to compose in American in Paris. And then he returned to New York City, and it's where he wrote Porgy and Bess with Ira, his brother, and the author Du Bois, get this, nice name, interesting name, Du Bois Hayward. Initially a commercial failure, Porgy and Bess is now considered one of the most important American operas of the 20th century. Gershwin moved to Hollywood, composed numerous film scores until his death in 1937. He died from a brain tumor. So we're going to put on a little bit of music. This is called, you're going to be familiar with this. This is an original. This is recorded in 1940, and it's called Summertime. Brown, the famous soprano of the period. And you'll hear that song done repeatedly. Janis Joplin did it in the sort of tragic blues singer. This is a period where a new form of music was being born. Pretty interesting, I think. Jazz. It originated in the late 19th and early 20th century in southern United States. It's sort of a combination of European harmonies and a form of African musical elements, polyrhythm, syncopation. The scholars have gotten at this to try and understand what we're hearing. And then Louis Armstrong was one of the most famous musicians in jazz. And he said to Bing Crosby on his radio show, swing, well, we used to call it syncopation. Then they called it ragtime, and then blues, and then jazz. Now it's swing. J.J. Johnson, jazz musician, said, jazz is restless. It won't stay put, and it never will. Think about the term riffing. You know, we use that, you hear that around. All it means is playing, being creative and putting notes together in particular expressions. And most of it, we know, improvisation is commonplace in is a landmark, if you will, of jazz. But there is also, there was, and today, a resurgence of improvised classical music. And it is fascinating. I mean, so a lot of us, you might, you know, when we're hearing a concert of our favorite musicians, might think, you know, it's pretty closer. It's exactly what was on the album. But oftentimes, the musicians are innovating, putting in new phrases and new timings to give that music more pop for them. So it's not just the same plunk, plunk, kerplunk. So that's, and you know that the companion, Masonic Companion is opened with some early, early music, very earliest trumpet solos, solo. And it was Louis Armstrong that was the innovator that brought that about. So that's the tune that you hear at every opening of the show. Today we'll play a little bit more about, why don't we get into some Louis Armstrong, see what he can do to our souls. Summertime, hey? Anyway, are you, we need something a little more libaceous and uplifting. Nothing better than I could think of than to talk about a beverage, especially on a day like today. We've got to talk about the history of the world in six glasses. This is the day that Ralph Waldo Emerson was born. There you go. Have at it. Sunday, the 25th of May. And, you know, we've quoted our Waldo Emerson on the program different times. So, and this is all, you know, when somebody goes over the top with their faith, sometimes they get themselves in a little bit of trouble. This is a day in history when the Edict of Worms declared Martin Luther an outlaw and heretic. There you have it. That was in 1521. Let that be a lesson. He was asked to retract his teachings condemned by the Pope, but he refused. And various theologians argued with him for a week, but he would not change his position. So on the 25th of May, they got fed up, and they said, all right, you're an outlaw. And the lines of the Reformation were just rigid. Who hid Luther to protect him from their enforcers? Oh, my. This is also a day when Argentina declared independence from Napoleonic Spain, and that was in 1810. And in 1812, an earthquake destroyed Caracas, Venezuela. Yep. And in 1861, John Merryman was arrested under suspension of writ of habeas corpus. It's important to us. And that sparked a Supreme Court decision leading to protecting the writ. It's also a day in 1878, Gilbert and Sullivan's opera, HMS Pinafore, premiered in London. Now we should pick that up. Those boys were Masons. Let's we'll get back to that. And this is a day in 1919, Casey Stengel releases a sparrow from under his baseball cap. Tell me no. A little more serious matter in 1915. 105,000 casualties at the Second Battle of Ypres. 105,000 casualties. God bless you, boys and girls. It's also the day when Babe Ruth hits his last three home runs. Yeah, that was in 1935. Not so long ago. And first airmail letter to circle the globe returned to New York at this day in 1937. You know, new machinery was being accessible. There's more disposable income. The 1948, the 30th PGA Championship was won by Ben Hogan at Norwood Hills Country Club in St. Louis. Wow, not so long ago. This day in 1951, Willie Mays played his first major league game. He went 0-for-5. There you go. And ground is broken for a new stadium in St. Louis in 1964. And Muhammad Ali KO'd Sonny Liston in the first for heavyweight boxing title, the first round, 1965, on this date. We all can see that in the posters and that mystery punch. This is also the day when the Beatles Live were restored at Star Club in Hamburg, Germany, was released. And Liverpool wins this 22nd European Cup, won in Rome. So all of those of you who've grown up with Star Wars, in 1978, Star Wars was released. And the state, 1983, France performed its first nuclear test. Ouch, jeez. So there you have it, eh? There's a lot more, but a bit about baseball and stuff like that going on. How about a little bit about getting liquored? They're all out there. I remember the pious old ladies. They couldn't talk about somebody, you know, a few old fellas sitting under a tree sharing a drink together. They would do it in a very malicious, withering, shrewish way. Ah, they're sitting there getting liquored up. Nothing like the voice of a shrew to cut through the start to peel the skin off the body, is there? But anyway, I'm talking about something a little more civilized, where we can share a drink and sigh a little bit and let the pressures of the world fall off our shoulders. No, not as a pathetic excuse for coping. And to all of the brethren who have developed a sickness because of their tendency to get into this too much, keep healthy. Your health is more important than you'll find that there's another reality without alcohol. This has to be enjoyed always in moderation. Always, always. That's the way it's called enjoyment, because it's moderation. Go over the top, thinking a little bit is good, a lot is better. Mm-mm-mm. That will bring the greatest man to his knees, and has, and will, and women. So I want to talk to you about the Greeks and the Romans. Remember, the Romans came after the Greeks, you know, so we had to get it through that military conquest and became a dominant culture. But we know that the Romans also recognized the talent, and the Greeks had the form of culture that was famous and was different and had processes that were quite, satisfying. And so the Romans approximated, borrowed, and updated a lot of the aspects of the Greek culture. Even their gods, they renamed the gods because they were clever, just plain clever. It wasn't done because they had conquered, you know, or it was we better. But you could say, you know, the Romans were bright. Especially at the onset, we know how things evolved, lessons learned. But we also know how Greek culture evolved, lessons learned, and taught to us even to this day. So we're going to talk to you a little bit about what it was like, what it would be like for us if we were in those days. So the Greeks, and this is about, we're still talking about drinking wine, And think about what lessons this takes for all of us. A little bit of a reminder here. The Romans drank their wine in a civilized manner, just like the Greeks. And that means they mixed it with water, which was brought into the cities through those, you know, you've ever seen those elaborate viaducts? And like we sit there and think, how? It's an amazing piece of engineering and craftsmanship to bring water into the cities. Each drinker, however, usually mixed wine and water for himself. And the communal krater, K-R-A-T-E-R, was, it seems, rarely used. Those darn Greeks, they had, you know, the world by the tail. The creator sat in the middle, and you had attendants that would just regulate the right proportion of wine and water to get the desired effect. Well, here, the Romans did that, each one for himself. The seating arrangement was less egalitarian than that of the symposia. Remember, we get together at the symposia for the Greeks, since some seats were associated with higher status than others. Ah, yes, the Romans. The convivium reflected the Roman class system, which was based on the notion of patrons and clients. Client citizens depended on patrons, who in turn depended on patrons of their own, and each patron provided benefits, such as a financial allowance, legal advice, and political influence, to clients in return for specific duties. Clients were expected to accompany their patrons to the forum each morning. For example, the size of each patron's entourage was a sign of his power. If a patron invited a client to a convivium, however, the client would often find himself being served inferior food and wine to those of other guests, and might find himself the butt of other guests' jokes. Ha-ha, Pliny the Younger, writing in the first century AD, described a dinner at which fine wine was served to the host and friends, second-rate wine to other guests, and third-rate wine to freedmen. Those were former slaves. These coarser, cheaper wines were often adulterated with various additives, either to serve as preservatives or to conceal the fact that they had spoiled. Pitch, which was sometimes used to seal amphora, was occasionally added to wine as a preservative, as were small quantities of salt or seawater, a practice inherited from the Greeks. Columella, a German agricultural writer in the first century, claims that when used carefully, such preservatives could be added to wine without affecting its taste. They could even improve it. One of his recipes for a white wine fermented with seawater and fenugreek produces a sharp, nutty wine very similar to the modern sherry. Mulsum, M-U-L-S-U-M, a mixture of wine and honey, emerged as a fashionable aperitif during the reign of Tiberius in the first century, while rosatum was a similar drink flavored with roses. But herbs and honey and other additives were more commonly added to lesser wines to conceal their imperfections. Some Romans even carried herbs and other flavorings with them while traveling to improve the taste of bad wine. While modern wine drinkers may turn up their noses at the Greek and Roman use of additives, it is not that different from the modern use of oak as a flavoring agent, often to make otherwise unremarkable wines more palatable. Below these adulterated wines was posca, a drink made by mixing water with wine that had turned sour and vinegar-like. Posca was commonly issued to Roman soldiers when better wines were unavailable, for example, during long campaigns. There was, in effect, a form of portable water purification technology for the Roman army. When a Roman soldier offered Jesus Christ a sponge dipped in wine during his crucifixion, the wine in question would have been posca. Finally, at the bottom of the Roman scale of wines was lora, L-O-R-A, the drink normally served to slaves, which hardly qualified as wine at all. It was made from soaking and pressing the skins, seeds, and stalks left over from the winemaking to produce a thin, weak, and bitter wine. From the legendary Falernian down to lowly lora, there was a wine for every rung on the social ladder. One of the greatest wine tastings in history took place around 170 AD in the imperial cellars in Rome. Here, at the center of the known world, was the finest collection of wines available anywhere, a collection built up by successive emperors for whom cost was no object. The end of these cool, damp cellars, pierced with shafts of sunlight, descended Galen, personal physician to the emperor Marcus Aurelius, on a singular mission to find the best wines in the world. Galen was born in Pergamon, now Bergama, in modern Turkey, a city in the Greek-speaking eastern part of the Roman Empire. As a youth, he studied medicine in Alexandria and then traveled to Egypt, where he learned about Indian and African remedies. Building on the earlier ideas of Hippocrates, Galen believed that illness was the result of an imbalance of the body's four humors: blood, phlegm, yellow bile, and black bile. Surplus humors could accumulate in particular parts of the body and were associated with particular temperaments. The buildup of black bile in the spleen, for example, made one melancholic, sleepless, and irritable. The humors could be brought back into balance using techniques such as bloodletting. Different foodstuffs, which were deemed to be hot or cold, wet or dry, could also influence the humors. Cold and wet foods were thought to produce phlegm. Hot and dry foods, yellow bile. This systematic approach, promoted by Galen's voluminous writings, was hugely influential and was the basis of Western medicine for more than 1,000 years. That it was utter nonsense only became clear in the 19th century. Galen's interest in wine was mainly, though not entirely, professional. As a young doctor, he treated gladiators using wine to disinfect their wounds, a common practice at the time. Wine, like other foodstuffs, could also be used to regulate the humors. Galen regularly prescribed wine and wine-based remedies to the emperor. Within the framework of the theory of humors, wine was regarded as being hot and dry, so that it promoted yellow bile and reduced phlegm. This meant wine was to be avoided by anyone suffering from a fever, a hot and dry disease, but could be taken as a remedy for a cold and wet disease. The better the wine, Galen believed, the more medically effective it was. Always try to get the best, he advised in his writings. Since he was treating the emperor, Galen wanted to assure that he was prescribing the finest possible vintage. Accompanied by a cellarman to open and reseal the amphora, he headed straight for the Falernian. Since all that is best from every part of the world finds its way to the great ones of the earth, Galen wrote, from their excellence must be chosen the very best for the greatest of them all. So in execution of my duty, I deciphered the vintage marks on the amphora of every Falernian wine and submitted to my palate every wine over 20 years old. I kept on until I found a wine without a trace of bitterness. An ancient wine which has not lost its sweetness is the best of all. Alas, Galen did not record the year of the Faustian Falernian vintage year, eventually deemed most suitable for the medical use of the emperor. But having identified it, he insisted that Marcus Aurelius should use that wine and no other for medical purposes. This included washing down his daily medicine, a universal antidote designed to protect the emperor against illness generally, and poisoning in particular. The notion of such an antidote had been pioneered in the first century by Mithridates, the king of Pontus, or the region which is now known as northern Turkey. He conducted a series of experiments in which dozens of prisoners were given various deadly poisons in order to determine the most effective antidote to each case. Eventually, he settled on a mixture of 41 antidote ingredients to be taken daily. It tasted disgusting. Diced viper's flesh was one ingredient, but meant that Mithridates no longer had to worry about being poisoned. He was eventually overthrown by his son. The story goes that holed up in a tower, the king tried to kill himself, but ironically found that no poison had any effect. Finally, he had to ask one of his guards to stab him to death. Galen extended Mithridates' recipe considerably. His recipe for theriac, a universal antidote to poisons and a general cure-all, contained 71 ingredients, including ground-up lizards, poppy juice, spices, incense, juniper berries, ginger, hemlock seeds, raisins, fennel, anise, and licorice. It is hard to imagine that Marcus Aurelius was able to appreciate the taste of Falernian after swallowing such a mixture, but he did as he was told by his eminent doctor, and washed it all down with the world's greatest wine. So, the next question that we're going to address with this is, why Christians drink wine and Muslims do not? Always connections. Always a matter of belonging. Always. So we have, if a man born with a mathematical faculty, and by training that faculty year after year may immensely increase his mathematical capacity, so may a man be born with certain faculties within him, faculties belonging to the soul, which he can develop by training and by discipline. Think about it. When I meet a new person, I am on the lookout for signs of what he or she is loyal to. It is a preliminary clue to the sense of belonging and hence of his or her humanity. Yeah, here's a statement by Salman Rushdie, the writer. Stories in families are colossally important. Every family has stories. Some funny, some proud, some embarrassing, some shameful. Knowing them is proof of belonging to the family. And that intrepid sailor, the first man to navigate around the world in a little sailboat all on his own. Captain Fisher, he says, the commander with a party of young ladies from the city and gentlemen belonging to his ship, came one day to pay me a visit in the midst of a deluge of rain. Friends. The feeling of being an underdog, not belonging, is very much me. You harbor a little feeling of resentment towards the upper dog. It's from Asa Larson, said that. Anyway, we let it all go. If there is something that's troubling you, the way of managing it is to let it go. Let it go and approximate a friendly demeanor, and soon that insipidness, that nastiness, the discomfort will disappear. It's been a pleasure having you here today. A little bit Masonic, a little bit of connecting us with some brethren, musicians. Here's another one, and then we're going to follow it up with a little bit of Canadian Anna, just because we're broadcasting from a Canadian setting. I hope the world is kind to you this week, and I hope that you're able to search out the kindness that you deserve. You are a Freemason, and it's not an easy challenge, but one that you can do gently to within yourself, that every day you have the opportunity to not neglect your needs, but to achieve, to work diligently. Remember, 10,000 hours. It's a beautiful experience if you need it to be and you search for it. It's there.
I see trees of green, red roses too. I see them blue for me and you. And I think to myself, what a wonderful world. I see skies of blue and clouds of white. The bright blessed day, the dark sacred night. And I think to myself, what a wonderful world. The colors of the rainbow, so pretty in the sky, are also on the faces of people going by. I see friends shaking hands, saying how do you
because at last we found that we just couldn't